Welcome to Red Cedar Ranker. This is our fourth episode. My name is Ed Glazer. I'm the general manager of the student radio station, Impact 89 FM, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-sidekick.
Colleague. Yeah, I'd like to be promoted eventually. So.
Well, you're doing great. We'll see. Your six-month review. Welcome, Mr. Fletcher.
Oh, hello, Ed. How are you?
Good. Doing well. And I think, I don't know if it's am I allowed, but congratulations are in order. You recently defended your dissertation proposal.
Oh, yep. Successfully. Yeah, thank you very much for that. Thank you. Now it's actually doing the dissertation. So that's just a small part of it. But yeah, we'll get there.
Don't you have interns do that?
No, I can't delegate the dissertation. I don't think. Paulette, does MSU have a policy on delegating dissertations?
Do you know? I think it does. Okay. Steph, and I wouldn't advise that you do that.
Okay. Thank you so much. Glad I.
Well, it's a good thing you checked with that.
Yeah.
And we have a guest, as we often do. This time we're lucky to have Paulette Granberry Russell. She is the director for the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives and also the Title IX coordinator and senior advisor to the president. So welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you.
Yeah. And Paulette, can you give an introduction to yourself and your three titles?
Oh, geez. We can start with Title IX coordinator. Title IX, I think, at least I hope most people understand, Title IX basically precludes discrimination on the basis of gender, particularly in this case in higher education. And Title IX coordinator basically means that I am the institution's administrator over issues that impact or are related to Title IX. In this case, if we're thinking about discrimination, if we're talking about sexual harassment, if we're talking about sexual assault, those issues would fall under the review of my office. Mm-hmm. And then as senior advisor to the president for diversity, we hold as one of our core values inclusiveness, which basically represents a diverse campus community, but also assuring that there are ways in which we can do our work to create that more inclusive living, learning, and working environment. So there's ways that I impact that as well. And then as director of the Office for Inclusion, we have four focus areas: institutional equity, which the Title IX work falls within, but broader non-discrimination work, both in terms of the university's anti-discrimination policy as well as state and federal non-discrimination laws; education development, that's related to ways in which we enhance diversity and inclusion at Michigan State and major university programs like the Dr. King Celebration, and of course this year Project 6050, which I would be happy to talk with you a little bit about; and also, so that's the community building piece, and then there's the research and assessment work that's associated with that. So that's kind of in a nutshell all three titles. How's that?
Wow.
Yeah, that's quite a body of work.
Yeah. I don't know about you, but I feel lazy now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you should.
fair enough. Oh, this is off to a good start. Yeah. I like this one. Well, we usually start off with, after introduction, a little Go Green roundup of Spartan news. And I think the big news of the day probably is the billion and a half. How do you say?
It
1.5
be said
billion.
Like Dr. Evil in the Austin Powers movies. I feel 1. Like $1 billion
fundraising campaign announced recently. And that is a huge undertaking for the university. Quite exciting.
Yeah, it's the silent phase has been underway since 2011, and I think I read the statistic of the university's already raised $780 million from 200,000 donors in the silent phase of the campaign.
Wow.
Recent large gifts that probably were, I don't know, well-timed announcements, I'm assuming, on the university's part, was the $10 million gift of the Scandalaris family to the athletics department, as well as the $25 million gift of Eli and Edith Broad to further help enhance programs, particularly at the graduate level, I think, at the in the business college. So, Paulette, have you been doing fundraising?
We do our best to help the university in this effort, but I think, you know, one of the specific goals associated with the capital campaign is ways in which we can increase endowments for student scholarships. So I think to the extent that that is one of our primary goals as a result of this work. I think that's a fabulous thing. The cost of higher education for some students seems extremely difficult in terms of a hurdle to overcome. So the more we can get alums and others who are true Spartans to give in support of our students, that's what we hope to see happen as a result of all of this.
Sure. But just for listeners who often, I think, wonder, how does fundraising actually work? What are the mechanics? What are the mechanics? So pretend I'm a donor. What do you say? Do you try and woo me? Do you try and find something that's in my interest? Or do you just, pull it Artful Dodger style in Charles Dickens and grab my wallet and then leave?
Well, a lot of it depends on the individual. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think in this case, what I would do with you, Stefan, is kind of cultivate you for the long term, because as a person who's completing their dissertation, I'm not sure how deep your pockets are.
Yep, but grad assistant stipend is not hefty, I'll tell you.
But what I would want to make sure is I'm cultivating you for the future is make sure that you understand and value the work of Michigan State, which I know that you do. And then, of course, what I would hope is that over time, as you start your giving now, that towards the future, I'm creating that kind of affinity that you have to your institution. And I know you already have that. And then, over the future, I may then ask you, tell me a little bit about your interest in Michigan State. And what is it about Michigan State that you particularly valued? And if you were to say to me, well, my particular, what I value the most from Michigan State is the way in which we incorporated diversity in the work that we did. And then I would say, tell me a little bit more about that. And then I identify where your particular interest is, because for me, in the line of work that I'm responsible for at Michigan State, I want to identify donors that hold those same values. And I think for the most part, Spartans do. Mm-hmm. They understand the values of the institution. They understand the values of being in a diverse campus environment. And hopefully from that, I might say, well, are you interested in student support, for example, through scholarships? And you'd say, yes. Well, you know what? We may have an endowment that is of particular interest to you, Stefan. Mm. And then I'd go from there.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Do you have a blank check that you could bring or leave with us today?
Yes. Right?
Yeah, I do have blank checks available, and they remain blank because of a lack of funding in the account to which they're associated.
All right. Good thing you asked the question.
Does that kind of help, though? Are you encouraged? Are you inclined to give?
I'm encouraged to provide whatever is in my wallet right now, which, Paulette, I mean, it's certainly, finding things that are in my interest, like you said, diversity or particularly in my case would be graduate students and professional student development. That would be certainly a way of looking at it.
Yeah. So. I mean, I started giving as soon as I graduated from Michigan State. And, I had a student call me, and this was a very long time ago now, but they asked me, would I be willing to give? And the one thing that I recognized, I was first generation at Michigan State, and the impact that Michigan State had on my life, I was the first in my family to go. I understood the value. I understood the opportunities that were presented to me. And Michigan State offered that to me. Mm-hmm. And I felt it was very important, even though if one were to go back and look at my giving history, they'd find I started at $5. Mm-hmm. But those, over time, that $5 has increased. Mm-hmm. And then when I started at Michigan State almost 16 years ago, then I was in a much better position to give more. And one of the things that through our office, we endowed the Dr. Martin Luther King Scholarship. And again, it's intended to support students who represent the legacy and do, and have continued in that frame of work. And mm-hmm. so it's creating those opportunities. And for someone like myself, it was, what did MSU do for me? It opened my life. It opened up the world to me. So why wouldn't I give?
Mm-hmm. I think if you're not careful, they're going to add a fourth title. You're going to get some sort of assistant vice president or vice presidentship of development.
Yeah.
I think that's in other duties as assigned.
Oh,
it's already included in there.
Yes.
All right. Well, if I had my wallet on me, I would give.
Thank you.
But fantastic.
Do you know where your wallet is? That's worrying.
Hmm. It's actually in my pocket.
Okay, right. Great.
Well, yeah, so that's outstanding. I think it's going to be interesting, although I feel like it's a little bit of a cheat to have already raised about half of your target donation before you announce the campaign. But I mean, I think that's not the worst kind of cheat I've ever heard. I don't know.
That's right. That's a lot of money to raise over time, mm-hmm. and it's not going to happen overnight. And so to the extent that you start your work early,
mm-hmm.
it's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah, that can be a core institutional value instead of procrastinating. Well, that would be a good...
Getting your homework done early.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of some of the students I've worked with over the years. And yeah, that's a good value that we should instill.
Preparation.
Mm-hmm.
Money management.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, where's the home ec courses? Those are the ones I needed.
I don't know. I mean, I'll go from the sublime, as it were, to the a story that I found slightly ridiculous, and that is obviously big win for Michigan State at the weekend over the University of Michigan, 35-11 in football. But Brady Hoke having to come out and apologize to Michigan State, to Mark D'Antonio, for his players planting a stake in the Spartan Stadium turf at the 35-yard line before the game. The stake was supposed to be some sort of motivational symbol for his players. His players then took the motivational symbol out to the field and apparently put it into the turf. Our athletics department, certainly Coach D'Antonio and the players, took umbrage to that. It's being kind of alluded to as the reason why we, you know, went for a touchdown in the closing minutes of the game, as opposed to running out the clock. The quote from Coach D'Antonio: "We try to handle ourselves with composure. That doesn't come from a coach; it comes from the program. Throwing the stake down in our backyard out here and coming out there like they're all that got shoved up. ... It got shoved in the last minute and a half." So my questions are: one, a tent stake? I don't know. Maybe that holds some sort of motivational value for them. I don't know.
Yeah, when you first brought up the news item, I literally thought you meant like a filet mignon.
Someone had gone to Outback Steakhouse.
Yeah. I thought, what an odd motivational...
Yeah, it motivates me. I mean, certainly I get motivated by a good filet mignon.
Sure.
And why put it in the ground?
It's so odd. And it just makes me think, you don't have good, control over the players, you know? That's just, if your guys are doing that.
I thought there was a miniature construction project happening. I was unclear as to why they did that. Paulette, did you hear much about this? Have you...
I happen to be at the game.
Okay. Did you see the stake?
Actually,
can you describe the stake?
I missed the stake.
Oh, okay.
I heard about the stake later. I think I was probably, out getting popcorn or something at the time. But no, I heard about the stake. So... You know, it's on some level, it's football, and I know it's all about the rivalry, perhaps in poor taste, probably the sort of thing that provoked, in this case, I think, some consternation on the part of the coach and others. But I gotta admit, I did miss that part. I missed that part. So
yeah, I don't think anyone. Well, you just like to see that Michigan State has the classier program, as it were.
We won. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We won. And it felt good to be there. It was a beautiful day. It was a great evening. And, we won. So, yay. Go green.
There you go. Go white. So, do you want to get into some of your questions for...
Sure. Well, Paulette, we wanted to kind of invite you here primarily to talk about the It's On Us campaign that Michigan State is a part of. And for those who are kind of unaware of the campaign, can you tell us how it started and give us some background on it?
Well, I think for most of us in higher education, there's a growing appreciation and I think certainly a recognition that there's an expectation that higher ed do more to address issues of campus sexual assault and sexual assault that impacts our students. And so the It's On Us campaign grew out of a White House task force report about a year ago that basically identified a set of expectations on the part of higher ed to address sexual assault, not only in terms of how we investigate them and respond to them, but ways that we can prevent and educate. And the It's On Us was a public awareness campaign from the White House that basically not only talks about ways in which we can prevent this, but also acknowledge the role that men can play in preventing and responding to situations that might pose an opportunity for sexual assault to happen. So we talk about bystander intervention, and I think It's On Us is intended to raise not only the awareness of sexual assault, but ways in which we can step in appropriately to intervene and prevent.
And, Ed and I have had a couple of student leaders on the show the ASMSU president, yes. James Conwell, and, yeah. and the two of the Greek leaders from the Panhellenic and Interfraternity Councils. And yeah. how are students being asked to kind of participate in the campaign?
Well, as I understand it, the White House has reached out to student organizations across the country, in because quite frankly, I think the view is that to the extent that students can help, one, either spread the word, but also shift and help shape a culture on this campus that basically says, you know, it's not okay for sexual assault to happen. There are ways that we can intervene and be supportive of our brothers and sisters out there that may become victims of sexual assault. And why not students? I think to the extent that, you know, when we look at our campus, what, close to 50,000 students yep. that make up Michigan State, and understand that they have a responsibility in this context, and that students, I think, are far better at talking to each other than an administrator might be. You know, even the Title IX coordinator is as good as we think we are, and as good as I think the staff within our office are, as well as those who are members of the sexual assault programs and other staff here. It is students that I think can have a more direct impact on students. Mm-hmm. And so it's inviting them to engage in ways in which they can help each other better understand the issues associated with it. So when they say, it's on us, it's on us. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, one other thing I do want to talk about is prior to the It's On Us campaign, mm-hmm. Michigan State had its own campaign, the There's No Excuse for Sexual Assault. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a bit of ways in which I think the It's On Us complements the There's No Excuse. So we often say, there's no excuse for sexual assault, it's on us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's on us, there's no excuse for sexual assault. So, it both of them blend very nicely, I think.
And was the origin for the No Excuse campaign sort of jumping on top of that, the task force that came out of the White House?
No, our campaign actually began even before the White House task force. So okay. We began our campaign almost 3 years ago. Mm. And it was in response, there was a Dear Colleague letter in 2011 that basically clarified the expectations of the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights on campus response to sexual assault. And it was felt at that time that it's not only part of our responsibility to investigate these, but also to educate so that students, as well as others on campus, better understand what sexual assault is, ways in which we can better respond and educate. And so that's where we started almost 3 years ago with No Excuse.
Great. And do you have a sense of where we kind of stack up against, not against, but in comparison to some of the other Big Ten schools or maybe universities at large in terms of sexual assault? Are we representative? Are we hopefully less?
You know, what I think is our efforts are working, mm-hmm. meaning we are finding that more students are reporting sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result of that, I wouldn't say that it means more sexual assaults are happening, but we're getting the desired result of the work that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the statistics from the U.S. Department of Justice were 1 in 5 students mm-hmm. Will either be the victim of sexual assault or attempted sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
That's a significant number.
Yeah.
But it's also
mm-hmm.
the most underreported mm-hmm. incident that happens on our college campuses. And so mm-hmm. the outcome, or the desired outcome, is for more to report, and that's happening. And I think it's a result of the education that's being done. I think it's the work that's being done in tandem with our office through the sexual assault program and student affairs, the sexual assault relationship violence education that's going on for incoming students, the fact that we're requiring all incoming students to view a video that helps to define, you know, what sexual assault is and what the campus resources are. All of those things are working together that I think, I can't speak for other campuses. I can certainly speak with respect to what we're doing here. And I think we're getting the outcomes that we want to see, which is more reporting.
Great.
I mean, broadly, Paulette, I think that 1 in 5 statistic, I mean, is quite stunning.
Yeah.
And very negative. And it just leads to the question, like, how did colleges and universities generally like get to this place where it's a 1 in 5 number? What are the you know, it's mind-boggling that it's you know, one in five people are affected. It's an absolute tragedy that it's one in five people. How did you think the society got to a place culturally where it became that high?
Well, I think you just said, how did society? And I think that we often talk about higher ed and in our college campuses being a microcosm of society. So the question, I think, you know, not to place this inappropriately on society, but I think appropriately it does belong, you know, at a level where we look societally at what has happened. And why is it that victims of sexual assault don't report sexual assault? Mm-hmm. And I think to the extent that if society has made it particularly difficult for individuals to overcome certain hurdles, you know, whether it's through law enforcement, whether it's through the judicial system, whether it's through, you know, a culture that somehow has allowed the victim to feel as though they're responsible for what has happened to them. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's what I wore or the fact that I had too much to drink or, you know, whatever it is. I've had these conversations. I have a 17-year-old daughter. I have a 19-year-old son. And the conversations that I have with them today are very different than the one I might have had with them 5 years ago, before, like most of us, a heightened awareness around sexual assault, especially with respect to college campuses. And both of mine are now at college. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I say to either one of them, you should be able to do anything. You should be able to wear whatever you want to wear. You should be able to drink as much as you choose to drink, hopefully not in a way that harms you, without fear that you will be raped, mm-hmm. or sexually assaulted. And unfortunately, that's not the way this typically works. Oftentimes, it's what she wore, or what he did, or, you know, how much they had to drink that contributed to this happening to them. Really? You know, and I know that there are behaviors that perhaps put you at greater risk of something bad happening to you. But it's not blaming the victim for something that has occurred. And so I think societally, these are issues. These are the deeper conversations that we need to have. So I don't mean to, and this is a serious subject. Mm-hmm. And I think it should be taken seriously. But to your question, I think it is a societal. And it's an issue that our college campuses face, not unlike the question and the issue that's faced in the broader society as well. So how do we change the culture? You know, through education and by being consistent in our message and, you know, making sure that individuals understand when there is consent and under what circumstances is a person able to give consent and being mindful of all of those things.
Mm-hmm. How, you mentioned the reporting, you know, and encouraging people to report incidences. How do students report incidences here on campus? How are we encouraging and who do they report it to?
Well, there are multiple places to report, and individuals, obviously part of the educational campaign, particularly for incoming students, is that they become aware of places that they can report. But it can, for some, they may report it to an RA. For some, it may be a faculty member. For others, it could be a staff member. For some, it's law enforcement. For others, it may be through the sexual assault program. For others, it may be at a hospital, if they believe that they've been the victim of a sexual assault, if they are the victim of a sexual assault. And sometimes it's it can be multiple places that an individual might go. They may start with the police, and then they may report it also to the sexual assault counselor. Mm-hmm. Because if it happens and it involves a MSU student, the expectation is, especially for staff and faculty, that they understand that they are what we call mandatory reporters. And so they will report that to the MSU police and to the Office for Inclusion, our office. And so multiple places. But that also means that all of those touch points are places that we have to have a clear understanding of what happens next. Mm-hmm. The first thing is always getting the resources to the individual that alleges that they're the victim of sexual assault. And so it's making sure that they get the counseling and the other support services that they need.
I wonder if some of the educational campaign isn't targeted, should not be targeted just at the students. That's obviously the really important part, but also at the level of, you know, staff and faculty, like you're talking about.
Yeah. And we do. Mm-hmm. And in fact, our education, whether it's the, if I think about this in the context of the It's On Us, whether it's There's No Excuse for Sexual Assault, we are in the process right now of developing what we call, right now it's e-learning, but it's mandatory education for faculty and staff so that we're all clear about what our responsibilities are with respect to campus sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
So it's clear that whether it's because I'm a mandatory reporter or I may not be clear about what consent means, I may not understand what incapacitation is, I may not be real clear about where the campus resources are, and ways in which I can show empathy to an individual who's a victim of sexual assault. All of those things will be incorporated in the education that we're going to be doing campus-wide.
Great.
And MSU has kind of, at least at the start of the year, I think there were a couple of news reports talking about MSU's, amending its sexual harassment policy.
Right.
Is that process, where is that process now, and when will we see it published? And what are we looking at when we talk about amending the policy?
Well, we're looking at, a far more comprehensive policy that has evolved over time, certainly over the last 3 years. The major revisions were made in the policy in January 2011, and that was in response to the Dear Colleague letter and some other guidance that institutions were receiving, as well as looking at whether what other institutions were doing. So we expanded the policy, the university sexual harassment policy, in 2011. And then over time, again, with the White House task force and the changes in the Violence Against Women's Act, mm-hmm. we knew that we were going to have to expand the coverage. So now we're expected to investigate domestic violence, relationship violence, and stalking, which adds more to the range of things that we will have to do and the education that we'll have to do with respect to that. But we needed to make a far more comprehensive policy to respond to the task force recommendations from the White House, as well as the changes in the Violence Against Women's Act. And so we've kind of folded into the 2011 sexual harassment policy what's mm-hmm. now going to be the relationship violence sexual misconduct policy.
Okay.
So it's fairly extensive. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a Q&A that's attached to that, as well as expanded education around that. It's quite a bit of work. We've mm-hmm. We also have a sexual assault relationship violence task force that is going to look at the work we've done over the last 10 years from the time of our first sexual assault task force in 24.
Okay.
So that's going to be off the ground probably in the next couple of weeks. So
okay.
Got a lot of work ahead of us.
Yeah, one of my questions follow up is, do you have any fun parts of your job, or is it always just protecting everybody from everything bad that could potentially happen?
It depends on what day of the week you ask me. But, you know, I would have to say, you know, and the people that kind of support this work at Michigan State, they do it because it's something that they have a great passion for. I mean,
yeah.
How could you not have passion for, whether it is trying to create a space where people feel supported? How could you not want to be associated with an effort that intends to create an inclusive campus community? So that there's a lot of good. I mean, this is the part of it that on its face seems overwhelming, but when you think about what the potential impact of this is,
yeah.
you know, it's pretty awesome, and it feels great.
Yeah.
You know, but it's a lot of work. It
sure.
is a lot of work. But we're not doing it singularly by ourselves. We've got great partners all over this campus, whether it's COGS, whether it's ASMSU, whether it's the fraternities and sororities that have all joined us in this work. It's law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Our MSU police department just created a special victims unit. And so we're working together as a community. And I think that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
I like it.
I know a radio station that would be glad to help with messaging.
Okay. Is it Impact?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Okay. Impact with an impact. I got it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you have by allowing us this opportunity to talk with you.
Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely, you know, be happy to do more messaging and PSAs and whatever we can do to help. But I also was just kind of wondering, you know, a big part of education, obviously, is your coursework and, you know, your major and stuff. But I also wonder, you know, if just the experience of being on a campus like Michigan State University, where, you know, these issues are taken very seriously, where inclusion is a core part of it. I wonder if that's an aspect of education that if you were not to go to MSU, you would never get otherwise. Do you ever think about sort of what the experience of an MSU student versus someone who doesn't participate in higher education or higher education at MSU? Do you ever think about kind of the nature of what our students get as a result of their experience here versus not?
Absolutely. Because, you know, there's an intentionality about it.
Sure.
Meaning, you know, we and people who, whether they're in student affairs, whether it's in the classroom, our work is intended to heighten students' awareness about the differences that they interact with every single day. And it's helping you to appreciate the fact that those differences are there, and that while it may feel uncomfortable at times, you know, part of the responsibility of higher ed is to create that space for you to engage across cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say there's an intentionality about that within higher ed, that's true, because this is something that individuals are thinking about every single day. It's what we do as our profession, as our avocation, and it's with a kind of deliberateness that may not happen outside of a learning environment like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, before I came to Michigan State, you know, obviously, like all high school students, I'm living the dream of a high school student, right? I'm just doing my day-to-day thing. I'm doing what I do. And unless the school, K through 12, is very purposeful about this, that's not the sort of thing you're always thinking about. You know, I have these experiences, but I don't always know what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had some positive things happen, but I also had some negative things happen to me. And both as a woman and as a woman of color, you know, I was told, and this was when I was in high school, and I won't go how far back that was, but I was told that I couldn't pole vault because girls didn't have upper body strength.
Mm.
Okay. And I was, you know, hurt by that, but I didn't know that I had recourse. My daughter qualified for states as a pole vaulter. I said, life's greatest irony, you know, the mom being told she couldn't and the daughter being, you know, someone who qualified for states in pole vaulting.
Mm.
And so, it's, you know, I can appreciate that. I don't know that she could necessarily unless I told her the story. And but you go through life and you don't always understand that there were others who paved the way for you to be able to have these experiences. And oftentimes that happens through higher ed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've had the opportunity to be in the classroom and working with students before. And I think we have a tendency to get very focused on the minutiae and the getting, you know, the grading and is this, you know, learning objectives and how is this going to prepare you for a job, you know, career and that sort of thing. And it seems like it's easy to lose the bigger picture and the, like you said, the intentionality of the student experience. And I got to think it's hard to measure some of that.
I suppose it could be, but can I throw something back at you? You said you're in a classroom, you know, and when I talk about intentionality and being deliberate, are there things that you do or could do to create that kind of purposeful opportunity for students to understand the differences that are right there in your classroom? Are there things that you do to kind of create, and I'm not putting you on the spot, but I could ask you to answer the question, but
it's turned into a reverse interview.
I know. It's like, but what sort of things?
Now.
Yeah. It's
why
like,
is Ed sweating?
Yeah. It's like, yeah, I see that beating right there on your forehead. And the audience, the folks out there can't see it, but I can. But no, it's really, you know, ways in which as a faculty member that you can create that space for students to be comfortable with the differences that are there, that you don't, you know, perhaps create an opportunity for something to be said that offends someone in the classroom and then just let it sit there and not be able to competently respond to it? How do you create diverse teams so that, you know, whether I'm an international student who is not particularly comfortable in the absence of someone creating that comfortable space for me, how do you create a way of U.S. students understanding, you know, how important it is for them to reach across cultures and interact with international students? I mean, that's when I talk about the intentionality. That's what this, I think, should be about.
Does the kind of education work that helping to develop or understanding among international students, does that differ slightly than what domestic students need on issues like sexual assault?
Sure, it does. I think, sexual assault and culture and ways in which one might react, respond, report are going to be very different. And I think what we have to do is recognize that and also address those concerns. Because within some cultures, talking outside of culture is not the sort of thing that's going to happen. So fear of police is also a concern. Mm-hmm. So if within the culture that you have come out of, police are not necessarily regarded as a friend. And that can be both as a U.S. citizen or someone that comes from another country where law enforcement is viewed very differently. Mm-hmm. How do you create an opportunity for those individuals to understand that at least here at Michigan State, there is a kind of understanding and education that we've done to sensitize our law enforcement on what it means to reach across cultures and allow them to understand that this is not something you should fear. But yes, culture does impact how we educate, respect, respond, prevent sexual assault.
You're kind of the role of the police as an authority kind of element of things kind of leads me on to one question that I did have for you, which is there is a consistent kind of undertone of the conversation about the role of the federal government or the role of different, you know, the complexities of federal guidance. And then also you have on the other side, Senator McCaskill from Missouri and her survey that she sent to, I think, 404 different colleges and universities. Do you have any kind of reaction to federal involvement? Is it confusing sometimes? Is it helpful? Is it not helpful?
Well, I guess I'm at a point now where it just is.
Okay.
I mean, it's just a fact.
It's just existing.
It's there. And I think on some levels, the clarity is important. Mm-hmm. I think there was a lack of clarity early on in this work. When I think back in the 90s when, you know, the sexual harassment law was evolving and some of the guidance from the feds were there, but it was never as explicit as it is now. Mm-hmm. And that's important because if you're held accountable to a set of regulations, it's helpful if it's clear. We may differ on that. I may, you know, as I look back over the years that I've been here, I felt that the federal guidance on this was not as explicit as it is now. And I think just time and experience has allowed, and case law has allowed that clarity to evolve. And so we're at a point now where there's expectations, there are mandates, there are recommendations. We have institutions all over the country that are doing a range of things to be responsive to the guidance, and we're no different, and we're going to do what we need to do.
Paulette, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask this. Obviously, in May, the Office of Civil Rights did come up with a list of universities that they were kind of working with to investigate, as it were, so some of the handling of Title IX cases, and Michigan State was listed. And you can correct me into the terms of the proficiency that Michigan State was on that list of, I think, 60 plus institutions.
Well, we're at 85, I think.
85
right now, yeah.
Okay.
A little over 80.
Is that process still an ongoing process, or where are we in terms of?
We still haven't heard anything yet.
Okay.
So we're waiting.
Okay.
Yeah, it makes you wonder what the criterion were, because there's an awful lot of universities and colleges that could have been included.
Yeah, I think it was just like, you know, there was a list of institutions off of the bat across the country, and I think it took at least a few people who weren't paying attention to the issue a little bit by surprise, I would say, Paula, in terms of the number of institutions. And again, it's part of this, I think, the increasing awareness on this issue that's been raised at various levels.
Yeah, I think that's a fair statement of, I think, what has gone on. And I, you know, when you read some of the statements that are out there from OCR, it's mainly around process and whether or not the institutions have followed the process in terms of assuring that whether it is investigating, whether it's the timeliness of those investigations, whether it's the ways in which we're interacting with law enforcement, it's a whole range of things that I think if you go back and look at the Dear Colleague letter, 16 pages worth of letter.
A long letter.
Yeah. So, you know, it's both from reporting to investigating to education to collaborations to campus resources. It's a broad range of things that are a part of that letter. And so we're all under that kind of scrutiny now.
Oh, go ahead.
No, after you.
Thank you. You know, if you look 5 years down the road, Paulette, or 10 years, or, you know, further down the road, where would you hope Michigan State University is on this issue? Is it, you know, that you have the increased reporting in place? Are there other specific goals, as it were, in mind, or you know?
Well, I think ultimately what you want, and we are seeing that from some of the data that we're getting from students, is a heightened awareness around what sexual assault is, a heightened awareness around the campus resources, a feeling of safety. And I think that's particularly important, trusting a process. And I think we're beginning to, you know, and we're really at the early stages of our work. In terms of the intensity of the work, but we are beginning to see, I think, students' awareness as well as their sense of safety increasing. Would we like to be able to demonstrate that there's no sexual assault that's happening to members of the MSU community? Ideally, I think any of us would love to see that as an outcome. That is reality, I don't think is possible. I want to see continued increase in the number of cases and incidents that are reported. And I want to see students change of behavior, you know, both in terms of understanding these issues, intervening when appropriate, understanding under what circumstances it makes sense to intervene. When I talk about behavior, I'd love to see more of that, and I think we will. I think as individuals understand that there are ways to recognize something that could potentially lead to an individual being sexually assaulted or an attempted sexual assault happening, looking for the signs of that and then stepping in. That's, I think, ideally as we move over the next couple of years, when you look at the It's On Us, and going back to what brought me to this show was this notion of it's on us and the value it plays in students' understanding of certain things that they can do to step in, you know. And when we talk about it's on us, that's what this is about, you know. So I'm looking forward to the next couple of years. I think we've got students who are excited about ways that they can support the effort. We've got students who have a voice, whether it's because of their own experiences as sexual assault victims, but also allies in assuring that members of the community understand what we can do differently. And I'm the forever optimist.
Yeah. You have to be in the job of protecting and serving, you know?
Yes.
I guess you don't have to be, but it probably helps.
No, it certainly is what we do.
Yeah. Thank goodness, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
So, yeah, no, I was going to ask the where do you see the things in 5 year question. So you beat me to the punch.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Bet you were surprised that I've already projected out 5 years, right?
Nope.
Should last you 50 years, I suppose.
Yeah. You've got, 10 jobs. And I expect nothing less.
Yeah. And that next generation of folks who want to do this work, I'm looking for them. So, send them in my direction and we'll develop their talents and then they can step in and you can interview them in 5 years.
All right.
All right.
Fair enough.
Well, that probably will lead us on to the kind of go white segment where we talk about events or things of interest. And you mentioned, and I always get the numbers the wrong way around.
60-50.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, talk to us about the 60-50 initiative.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Project 60-50, 2014 represents the 60th anniversary of the Brown v. Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court dismantling discrimination in higher ed or in education, public education. Mm-hmm. Not just higher ed, and the 50th anniversary of the signing of the 64 Civil Rights Act. And so almost 3 years ago, a couple of individuals, including John Beck and Nick Mercuro from the College of Law and the School of Human Resource and Labor Relations, approached our office and said, 2014 represents, significant anniversaries of, and I just mentioned what those two words, and the view was that maybe there's something big MSU can do to not only celebrate history, but also to educate and engage the campus community and maybe even the broader community around what are civil rights issues and human rights issues today. And I thought it was a great idea, and it took off. And since the launching of the campaign or the project in 2014, January 2014, on the King holiday, we've had over 150 conversations. So this is facilitated conversations on civil and human rights. And which have, when I say 150 conversations, but those 150 conversations have impacted thousands of individuals, both on campus and beyond. One book, one community this year. When you look at whether it was John Lewis, Michelle Norris, and Ryan Coogler, Fruitvale Station, and John Lewis's book, March 1, and Michelle Norris's The Grace of Silence, all of those issues touch on civil and human rights issues. And so it's ways that we partnered both within the campus community, but more broadly. Folks are loving this. That was one of those things that we kind of thought might happen, but we've been overwhelmed by the response to these opportunities to talk about what are continuing civil and human rights issues today. Human trafficking being one of those, elder rights, marriage equality, environmental justice, educational equity, just a broad range of things that people want to talk about.
That's great.
Yeah, we love it. This is one of those good things. You were asking me about the positive and great and wonderful things. This represents, in balance, it has allowed us not only to kind of continue this conversation about whether or not gender equity and sexual assault falling into that category, but also the broader range of things. And students have been fabulous. I mean, I'm always so impressed by students anyway, but I'm particularly impressed by the issues that they've raised. We've had high school students who wanted to partner with us on issues around gender bias. A group of four young women from one of our local school districts came to visit. We were having a barbecue, and it was a way of, it was a way of talking about some other things related to 60-50, and they came and they wanted to talk about gender equity and what they call boys will be boys. And it's getting at issues of ways in which boys and men can be allies and supporters of girls and women. Mm-hmm. And I was just delighted by that. And I've had students want to talk about, trans rights, these issues of environmental justice and brownfields and in urban gardens and water rights, and it just goes on. Students are amazing.
They love it.
So many diverse interests.
Yeah.
So many diverse interests. And so passionate about so many different things.
Yeah. And they just bring the rest of us along. And so, I'm going for the ride with them. So whatever it is that students find as important civil and human rights issues, we want to create the space if we can. And they're creating their own space. So if you go over to Mosaic in the Student Union, and look at the exhibit there, the Project 6050 exhibit, we ask them, who are your leaders? Who do you see as today's leaders around these issues? And what are the issues you want to talk about? And just let it go. And conversations have a way of taking off.
Mm-hmm.
Just create the space for it.
Mm-hmm.
Where can individuals find kind of more information about upcoming conversations or events, Paulette?
Just Google Project 6050, whether it's in the MSU search engine or just generally, or inclusion, if www.inclusion.msu.edu. That'll get you to all the information that you need.
All right.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and visiting with us. It's a woman of many titles because she's doing a lot for the university. We're very lucky to have her not only at the university, but here in our studios at the Impact. Paulette Granberry Russell, thank you so much for being with us here on Red Cedar Ranker.
My pleasure. Go green.
Go white.
Yeah.